We start today's program by considering some of the major national events of 2016 and how they may affect our communities and culture in 2017. That will include, of course, election season and Donald Trump's victory in the race to become the next U.S. president. But we'll do our best to talk about a lot of other things, including writing and philosophy and journalism and celebrities and all that sort of stuff. And I'll be doing that with best-selling author Lori Natero. Her latest book is Crossing the Horizon, a work of historical fiction about some very talented and interesting female pilots. Also here is writer and longtime KJZZ commentator and critic Robert Pala. He's also a contributor to Phoenix Magazine. Our third panelist is John Gabriel, editor-in-chief of Ricochet.com and a contributor to the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Welcome to you all. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
So, Lori, let me start off with the death of Carrie Fisher. From this context, I think that we're seeing so much reaction to people, and part of it is the special place she holds for people for many reasons, starting off with as Princess Leia when many of us were little kids and then moving on to an expansive range. How do you mark her passing? But also, why do you think we have this, so many of us have this relationship with people on the big screen, small screen, that just we feel this connection even if we never actually meet them?
You know, I think Carrie Fisher held, I can speak for myself, and my husband too, was one of those 10-year-old boys who watched Star Wars and never really got over it, you know? So, but for me, Carrie Fisher was probably the first woman in my lifetime that I saw who really went out there and kicked butt and took names as her character, as Princess Leia. And that was a really strong influence on me. And then later on, she went on to be this wonderful humorist, a very saucy woman, very angry at her dad. I'll never forget the, some interviews I saw about her talking about her father, which was not pleasant. But I thought, she really has the guts to go out there and just say exactly what she means. And I always felt that someday I would meet her. And I'm very, very sad. I don't know where our paths would have crossed. But I just wanted to say, God, I love you. And you're exactly who I want to be, drugs, booze, and all. I really want to emulate everything that you've done. So I think for women, especially my age, she was a really good role model and a very good archetype to follow. And she showed us that, I'm in charge of all these guys up here, and look at what I can do. I think that's awesome.
And guys, whether by Carrie Fisher or something broader, what about the celebrity attachment we have?
I think a lot of it has to do with the place that celebrities or television shows that get canceled or go off the air hold for us. They're markers of time that mattered or matter to us. So if you are an obsessive fan of the Mary Tyler Moore Show from the middle 70s, it might also, it might not just be because it's a brilliantly written and very well acted show, but also because you remember how lovely it was to be 12 and not have a job and not have a lot of responsibilities other than your homework and getting to bed on time. And so there's always a personal, I think, element to loving Carrie Fisher, or for me, Patty Duke. You know, Patty Duke died of sepsis. That doesn't happen all that often.
At a young age as well,
69. And, you know, I think she still had another 10, 15 years as a character actor in her. And maybe she died because she lived in Idaho where, you know, I mean, if you live in a big city, it's easier to get to the ER when you have an internal infection than it is wherever she was living in, you know, out in the boonies.
Yeah,
and I think the biggest effect for me is always musicians. And I think there's just an emotional connection. When I was a kid, like, especially all young boys in the late 70s, early 80s, going to see every Star Wars movie. So you have that emotional connection. And for me, it was just musicians. And this year started with the news that Lemmy Kilmister passed away, then followed by David Bowie. And it just went on and on. And it seemed like every month another great musician. Towards the end, you had Leonard Cohen. So all these people who, even though I've never met any of them, you feel an emotional connection because they kind of stir up those emotions in you, and it just makes it a lot more personal. You know, 100 years ago, you'd only have that kind of connection with family or friends or people in your neighborhood, and now it's just with the mass media, you feel it for these people you never have met.
Well, and Robert, even what you mentioned makes me think about the whole retro thing, because my wife and I tend to watch mostly old TV now, and probably because of that feeling. And they're not as good as we remembered, by the way.
Yeah.
But
BoJack is awesome.
No, that is the caveat. There is Laverne and Shirley might not be so funny in the early 21st century as you remember it. You know, I did meet Leonard Cohen, and he was that rarest of things in a celebrity. He was as magnificent in the moment as I feel like if you met him in passing at the grocery store, you would come away with a life-changing moment. And, yeah, that was a tough one for a lot of people. Yeah.
And we're all basically in the same generation. So when we hear, was anybody at this table, and maybe I'm just too square or something, but I was really amazed when Prince passed, how everyone seemed to recognize his greatness, even people who were maybe much older than he. Based on Leonard Cohen, Prince, George Michael, even David Bowie, is there one of those that feels like the biggest impact, any of you?
Oh, David Bowie, certainly, yeah. Because Robert and I are about the same age, and John and I, we are all about the same age. I'm in my 50s now. So David Bowie was very, very instrumental in my burgeoning punk rock, kind of identifying my musical place in this world when I was in high school and in my 20s. So that was really a big thing. And, of course, I had a major crush on David Bowie, so that didn't help matters.
Is music, though, even when it comes to the way that we use music, because obviously people go to concerts, but if you, especially these days in earbuds and headphones, are we as public with that? Like if we go see a movie and we're all sort of seeing Star Wars together, or maybe TV's a little bit more private, is there something different about the way we feel about music, perhaps? Talking about David Bowie. Music is universal in the sense that a lot of people like the same artists, but unless you're at a concert together, you don't really listen together. Maybe in the car listening on the radio or in your room listening on the earbuds. Does that change anything for anybody? John, you sort of say that's an intimate thing for
you.
Yeah,
I think it's going to be interesting. One thing about all these artists, you feel like you're seeing the passing of the last generation that did have that communal aspect of culture. When we were all in high school, someone appeared on with a musical guest on Saturday Night Live, everybody was buzzing about them. They were terrible. They were great. Can you believe what they did? And now you don't have that. Now it's you're looking at a YouTube video at 1 in the morning and, I guess this is a pretty good band. And you're done and you tell your friends, like, what are you talking about? I have no idea. So this shared culture is fading. And this year was especially tough because it was one hit after another. A few years ago when Johnny Cash passed away, that hit me. I was in a funk for a month, but that's because he was my dad's thing. My dad would sit on the end of the bed, play his guitar, play Johnny Cash songs for hours. And so that was like a piece of my childhood gone. Now that I'm a bit older, I feel like, no, Prince, I grew up with him. That's not fair. That's not right. He can't go yet.
You know, you talk about it not being fair. At least Prince and Leonard Cohen and certainly David Bowie had reached iconic status and had been celebrated in a very exemplary way. George Michael, our most recent musical death, had not yet acquired that burnished sheen to his career where we were looking back. And I can't speak, I kind of vaguely remember his hit records on the, but he did a great deal for commercial music and wrote some standards, some which is also very rare, and didn't get to live long enough to the point where somebody was doing a documentary about how brilliant he was or,
I think he was actually working on a show with HBO about his own life. Yeah, I think it was actually in not post-production, but I think they were working on it at that time. Right now, yeah.
Now, our producer, Sarah Ventry, is saying that there's a lot of stuff happening on a mass scale right now. Everyone's talking about things. Shared culture is more because people can see a favorite band playing a show overseas on Facebook Live. Maybe we just haven't embraced social media the way we all should.
we're in this very peculiar transitional period where music and photography are concerned, because it used to be that if you wanted the new Linda Ronstadt album, you went to the store and you bought a 12-inch disc and you took it home and everybody had the same 10 songs in the same order. And today, CDs are passé. And what is an MP3 exactly? I get to take out the songs I don't care for. I get to change the order of the songs that the producer lined up. It's very, very personal, as you said, and also distinctly different because of that.
Now, all of you are writers, and you're writers in different ways these days. Do you find, John, first of all, do you find that writing online is somewhat different than the columns you're putting in The Republic? Do you modify any of those from online? Does AZ Central have a different audience than the hard copy of the paper, for example?
Yeah, I think they're very different audiences. When you're writing for the web, it's a very transient thing. It's not something people are going to have a hard copy of to turn back to. And so I just make sure I kind of, to be completely pretentious, I look at a lot of, when I try to do a deep dive on the web, it's like intellectual prototyping almost. It's like, hey, let me throw this out here and get your comments to see if I'm full of it or this actually has a good point here. Mm-hmm. And half the time I'm full of it. And the other half, it's like, oh, okay, I can develop this and write something more about it later. But when you write for the print medium, you know, and it's kind of odd, I started out, my first famed career was as a paperboy for the Arizona Republic, and now writing for them, I feel like, oh, wow, this is an actual physical specimen that it'll be, you know, noted for the ages, and that obviously doesn't happen as much as it once did, but I try to be a little more bulletproof when I'm writing for them.
And Lori, in writing books, do you find that you have to start off writing for yourself? I mean, you've written historical fiction recently. Mm-hmm. You're known very well for being a best-selling humorist over the years. So does that change how you approach it? I mean, do you find yourself in a room writing and trying to write stories that people can relate to? How different is it from writing what would be a daily column, for example?
Well, you know, I wrote the daily column for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central, which was basically what I'm kind of still doing. But I get to experiment more and put more of myself in there and just really kind of say things that I certainly couldn't say in the paper. But what I'm finding now is that the publishing industry is changing so quickly. Mm-hmm. And not in a good way. And in fact, I think I'm going to be taking a step back from publishing for a while. And I've been told by an editor point blank that at one of the biggest house in the world, that she is no longer allowed to buy any book that isn't by a celebrity or a surefire blockbuster. So where does that leave us? Mm-hmm. You're going to be reading a lot about Nikki Sixx, I guess. Good luck with that. That's awesome. But as far as mid-list authors and literature, I see a very bleak future for that.
So you're saying if I want to write a book, I should change my last name to King and be Stephen King and just confuse a lot of people.
Right, yeah, or just, you know, yeah, or, yeah, you could just write under the name Adele, you know, you could do that as well. But, yeah, I think that the industry is changing, so even the standards when I was writing something are now changing so quickly and so fast. And I think that's just a complete reflection of not only the culture we're in, but also the election was a very good mirror back on our culture. You know, it showed us exactly what we were interested in, and that was reality TV, and that's kind of scary for me.
And we'll talk a lot more about that coming up with Lori Natero, John Gabriel, and Robert Pala as we wrap up 2016, look ahead to 2017 on KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks for being with us. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Robert Pala, John Gabriel, and Lori Natero about 2016 and what's to come potentially in 2017. So, Robert, we left off with Lori mentioning Donald Trump. I promised we wouldn't talk about him much, but now apparently is the time. So from a standpoint of how election season went and what has come of it, do you think people are more alarmed about Trump's victory and perhaps a certain percentage of his supporters that people are perhaps a little bit scared of to some extent, to be totally noncommittal in my comment right there? Is part of it because of the contrast of in the Obama administration, at least people who were from a more diverse background felt like, all right, here's someone who is diverse. Is it more that people are worried about what is to come? It is unknown. Or is it more because they think it's going to contrast so much with the last 8 years?
I think it's both of those things. I think for progressives and liberals, we spent the last 4, 6, 8 years saying, at last, our idea of a larger universe and a kinder, gentler universe is a reality, is becoming a reality. Mm-hmm. And there was this level of grace in the White House that certainly burnished that thinking and those politics. And now we are seeing the absolute flip side of that heading straight for us. We are standing in the middle of a freeway, and this woman-hating racist is barreling toward us, and it can't be good. I don't really think he'll take office and the next day announce, hey, I was only kidding.
Can it be possible, just to play devil's advocate, that he can be a terrible person and a racist, as many people would call him, but also not be a bad president?
Sure, of course.
No, because there are many people who would say that President Obama and his family, very classy, very smart people, maybe not that effective a president. If we look at just the actual.
Yeah, who's going to say that? Who in this room is going to say that?
No,
we have this guy.
Why
maybe.
Don't you people want to make America great again? That's all I'm
There you
asking.
Are. Mm-hmm. You know what I worry about, though? I worry about the middle Americans who voted for this guy because they really thought he was going to reinvigorate the coal industry and open the steel mills again. Now, the four of us are disappointed by our president, and we write and publish a screed, or we go to a salon and we bitch about it with our friends. I think people who are angry that the coal industry hasn't revived are going to set fire to things. I don't think they're going to sit down and write a thoughtful essay about how disappointed they are. That's my concern.
Okay.
And I know how that sounds, but really.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think just looking at how the left and much of the middle has been just wringing their hands over Donald Trump. As a former Republican, thanks to Trump, I kind of went through that already. I went through my Kubler-Ross stages of grief, and so I'm done with that. And I'm like, why are these people freaking out? Of course, Donald Trump is acting like Donald Trump. I'm not shocked when he tweets some dumb thing because I'm like, well, yeah, that's who he's been. But I did spend, 6 months earlier, I was like, has everybody lost their mind? How is this guy even on a debate stage, let alone running away with this thing? So, it does say, as Laurie had mentioned early, just about our culture, reality show culture. The debates weren't about, oh, okay, that's an interesting plan for Social Security. It was, oh, snap, he didn't say that. That's awesome. It was like a Real Housewives episode. And, oh, did you see what he said to her? Oh, what did she say back? Let's share some GIFs from this. So it is, I don't want to be, I'm already, getting to be the old fuddy-duddy, get off my lawn, but it is, okay, let's do some reading about the policies behind this and make sure this is the guy that you want.
Well, so why did this happen then, John, if we think about it? Were there a lot of people that didn't get polled? Were there a lot of people who just really are drawn to the idea of this guy is larger than life and the other people we've had are boring?
I think the latter is a lot of it. I think those people weren't exactly polled. It's tough to do polling now, just with cell phones. And, if the phone rings and I don't recognize the number, I don't answer it. And I'm sure a lot of people are like that. He also had the passion on his side because even many of the Hillary supporters who were voting for her were kind of like, okay, I'll vote for her. And Trump people were like, no, because I've talked to thousands of these true believers. And no, he is going to make America great again by building a wall and starting a trade war with China. That's our solution. And we'll bring back coal and steel and be shipbuilding in Philadelphia again.
So, Laura, what do individual people and communities do? Because it's now that the vote is official, he's going to be president in a few weeks.
We still have weeks. We still have like at least 21 days.
But so if you're someone who's concerned in your community, the guy's not going to be impeached. He's going to take office. So what would someone who's concerned about it do at a local level?
This is what I think is that, listen, if I could have applied for like election-based depression for disability, I would have totally done that. But that's not a category. I think we all stopped working we're still not working. But what I think is that there's not only a silver lining to this debacle, there's a golden lining. And what that means is that we have to remember there are more of us than there are of them. And I hate to put it in those terms, but that's basically where we are right now. Mm. She won the popular vote. That means there's more people who are progressive, liberal, and want a more caring, gentler society that is inclusive and includes everyone. We're all concerned. And if that means being a Democrat and that's a bad word, then I'm a bad word. But what I see is an opportunity for everyone to get up and stop being complacent. Your country is now smoldering. What are you going to do about it? This is time for everyone to get up and be active. What I want to see in this administration is the golden age of activism, where everyone pitches in. I'm trying to get my nephews involved. I'm trying to get my neighbors involved. I've started a Now chapter up in Eugene, Oregon, which had been defunct for almost a decade because we were fine with Obama in office. Women were not afraid to necessarily lose their rights so quickly. Now we're really on the line. Now things are very dangerous for us. So, and I'm not the only one. Our first meeting, we're going to have, I'm guessing about 150 people there when I go back to Oregon. It's not just us. This is the time for everyone to get up and spend a little bit of extra energy. You volunteer at the ACLU. You go to move.org. and you do those things and you get your country back.
Not to get too specifically political, because I think let's move on from this show. But I was thinking back as someone who looks back at election history and when most of us were very, very young, some political experts I've spoken to compare this to 1968 to 1972. So does a Donald Trump then lead to an ultra progressive someone in 2020 that no one can vote for because the person is too left, and then we end up with someone like Jimmy Carter?
I don't think Jimmy Carter was that bad of a president,
no.
To tell you the truth.
No, he was a good public servant.
I think he's a brilliant,
a fine human
smart
being,
man.
No question about that.
Right, but. Right. I think that we will see a backlash, just like we saw a backlash with Obama, with many people feeling disenfranchised that weren't of the quote-unquote elite. And I don't even know what that means, honestly. I just don't even know what that means. But I think that those felt that they were left behind and wanted to make America great again. I don't know when America's really stopped being great. I don't know when that happened. America is still great. It is still the best country in this world. So I don't really know if you want to turn back the wheels of time and go back to McCarthyism. But honestly, I don't see this as the 1968 or 1972. I see this as 1938. And we're in Berlin. That's what I see.
Okay. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Lori Natero, Robert Pala, and John Gabriel. And on that fun note, let's move to someone who, very, very famous local politician who lost after many, many victories, and that is Sheriff Joe Arpaio. John, what does that reflect about, does it reflect anything about this community in terms of how they're viewing diversity, how they're viewing inclusiveness, whatever it may be, or is it just that people thought, well, we've kind of had enough of him and his lawsuits?
Yeah, or we've all grown tired of seeing pink underwear. I'm not sure what exactly, but Joe Arpaio is someone, a very divisive figure. And just always, basically, if you ever want to be in the most dangerous place in Phoenix, get between Joe Arpaio and a camera. It was kind of the old joke about him. And I thought people got tired of his antics because it wasn't about doing his job. It was about getting press for Joe Arpaio. With all the federal lawsuits against him, with all the complaints of people in the jail, people who are not even convicted yet, some dying in custody, many being abused in custody. I think the community in general had had enough of him. And when you just saw his sweeps, I used to drive to an office and I would drive down Guadalupe Road and go through the very small community of Guadalupe. And every month or so, he would have his vans there and helicopters swooping down, just basically harassing the residents for no reason. And this community has been here before Arizona was a state. If anybody is the interloper in this situation, it's Joe Arpaio, not these people. And I think just this heavy-handed, ugly, people got tired of it. You had the whole immigration wars locally here several years ago, and I think the community has moved on from it and are just like, okay, let's get our act together. This guy is an embarrassment, and we don't want to support him anymore.
So, Robert, is he going to fade away, or because a lot of people consider him some kind of a character, is he going to show up on some of these Sunday morning TV shows as a pundit or something like that?
I hope he quickly becomes the punchline to a joke and stays there. Yeah, no, we don't want to see him evolve into something else where he has any access to any kind of power.
Anything to add to what John had to say? Do you think this indicates anything about the changing voting populace here, or was it just because it seemed that the numbers we saw indicated that it's because a lot of Republicans turned against him, not because we really saw that Latino turnout?
No, it was the Latino turnout, and that means that brown people are interested in saving their own communities and protecting their own communities, and that was something that was missing in the last election. There was a deep, they were unaware of what the election meant to them in many cases. That's a wide brush to generalize with, but the brown people showed up this time and said, no more of this. This is our community as well.
And Lori, no more green bologna, no more pink underwear?
I know.
Have you missed this being in Oregon?
There's enough of Oregon. We have people taking over, you know, nature preserves and things like that and causing $6 million of damage. But I don't miss Joe Arpaio. I'm not sure who will. You know, my parents probably will. They really liked him. But it was a sideshow, which is exactly what Trump is. It's a sideshow. It's smoke and mirrors. And there's some fireworks. And it's a bright, shiny object. And I think that's what people were attracted to and liked his. He was a busker.
We've got a few minutes left. Now, John, this is going to go, I'm going to go off script entirely, just very briefly. because the Ricochet.com, which you're the editor-in-chief of, I don't know, would we describe it as conservative, libertarian? I'm not sure.
Yeah, center-right, I would say.
But Pat Sajak writing columns? What? I'm watching Wheel of Fortune, and Pat Sajak is writing columns? What's going on?
Pat Sajak, yes. Not to brag, everybody, but we got this new artist on our roster, Pat Sajak, who wanted to vent his spleen about. He is kind of – it's kind of interesting because he is a bit older than all of us, and – he's kind of looking at the world going, huh, what exactly just happened? So it was kind of a fun column, and we like to Dana Gould, who's a comedian, definitely on the progressive side. We've had him write for us before, too, post-election going, what the heck just happened? So there's been a lot of these year-end articles, people just trying to figure out what's going on, and in the comments kind of mixing it up, which is a lot of fun.
A few minutes ago, we were talking about retro TV, though, and Chuck Woolery, former Wheel of Fortune host, is also this conservative. I mean, is there... I haven't heard Alex Trebek's comments about anything, so I'm not sure.
That's who I'm waiting for. So I'm kind of in the wilderness until we hear from Wink Martindale.
So last few minutes left. I'm not asking for predictions because this is not this kind of show. But, Robert, anything you're looking forward to in 2017, whether it's from this community, whether it's in the arts, anything that is, you know, other than Trump being impeached, can we...
I am not looking forward to the potential deregulation of architecture and geology and landscape architect, which is, we understand, on the horizon, and which would completely gut and kill a very important industry here. We will lose that industry. Builders and developers who come to Arizona to put up another high-rise will say, let's don't hire an architect from Arizona because they're no longer... they don't need to be licensed anymore. Let's hire someone from Colorado, and we're going to lose that income, and our industry will be harmed by that. I'm also looking forward to seeing what happens with the gentrification of the Arts District downtown. Roosevelt Row is less and less affordable to small galleries and to artist studios and the little boutiques that have sort of made that neighborhood what it's been recently. It'll be interesting to see where they go to or if they just go away, which would be bad.
John, what about you?
One thing that's been good to see growing up in this community since I was 6 years old, we moved here, is just seeing how downtown has changed. Before, it was just, you know, tumbleweeds rolling through after 5:30 p.m. And to see it lively is great, but there is kind of this gentrification effect where you kind of like the shady clubs that you've heard about only because your friend told you about it to see some underground band. So a lot of that's changing. So I really hope one problem with Phoenix has always been this kind of an authenticity thing and not just trying to replicate Williamsburg in downtown Phoenix. So I'm really hoping for more local culture. You get that in spades in Tucson, for instance. When you're in Tucson, okay, I'm in Arizona. I'm in. This is a different place. Phoenix, you're kind of like, I could be in Dallas or Miami or D.C. or whatever. So one thing I would like to see is just the local involvement and getting people more involved to have a little bit of culture.
And Lori, about a minute left. What are you looking forward to here or in Oregon?
You know what, in general, what I'm looking forward to is that when people, when politics aren't going great, that's when our arts flourish. That's when the best art is made. And that is what I'm looking forward to. That's what I hope is going to happen. Because, I don't know, we've had some good art, but not great art lately. So let's hope for that. And let's hope that everyone feels the need to get active in their community and come together. And if you want to affect change, it's within your grasp. You can do it. You just have to get up and make a phone call or find a meeting or people like you. And we can do this.
You want to give us a brief scoop on what your next book is going to be about?
My next book is hopefully going to be about an infamous Phoenix figure who committed a murder and made some very bad plans afterwards with body parts.
Try to piece those together. Lori Natero, her latest book is Crossing the Horizon, a work of historical fiction. We also had KJZZ commentator and critic Robert Pala. And our third panelist was John Gabriel, editor-in-chief of Ricochet.com. You can find his stuff in the Arizona Republic and azcentral.com. Thanks to all of you for looking back at 2016 with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you. For here and now.